the show.
Hello, hello, and welcome to this week's edition of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Great to be back with you again. And I think I officially, I just have to give my health progress reports. I have no stuffiness this week. It's been progressively lessening. Does anyone have any other health issues that we need to address in our old 30s plus age?
I actually have a various long and varied list of maladies being halfway through a pregnancy, but I'll just keep those quiet for now.
Maybe we will just keep those on the down low we do a complete round table.
My eyes start stinging after a while of editing articles on boundless.org.
I have chronic sneezing because of my allergies.
How about you, Steve?
I've got some empathy pounds from Candace's pants. Causing some pants problems.
Oh, no. Well, we're going strong. We've obviously worked ourselves to, whatever. We haven't lost our lives yet. We are actually at, this week, episode 26, which is halfway through the year.
All right.
Which totally, like, okay, Mott has learned
medicine. I had a frog in my throat.
We should have had like at least half a sheet cake here or something. Ooh, to celebrate.
I think, like, half, you know, we could probably
get back
to
my empathy pal.
We could get one ordered in here. Dave, that sounds really good to me right now. I'm craving it right now. Can we call the bakery?
Dave's going to run out for that. That'll be part of his new job description. But no, so we've actually made it half a year, which I don't know if you listeners have noticed that. Those of us who are on the table are like, 26 episodes, sure thing. But no, it's been good. It's been good.
Yes, ma'am.
And we've seen some good progress. I want to draw attention to my friends in the juice business, Bolthouse Farms.
Let's hear it for Bolthouse.
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 I mean, it's like,
which episode did you talk about them in?
Oh, it was just ages ago. It must have been a couple months ago.
It's when
least.
You were doing your cleanse for the race.
Oh, okay. Oh, so that, right. So that would have been around the beginning of April.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning of April with Bolthouse, yes. And
Bolthouse, the company with a conscience.
I am telling you, you get mentioned on The Boundless Show, and your profile just soars. Like, seriously, now they are just in the news.
I know.
Because one of their investors, or one of their key people, has decided to back the preservation of marriage as between one man and one woman in California. Scandalous, because you know you're not supposed to do that if you're a corporation. You're not supposed to support anything that has to do with values. So,
or at least not conservative values.
Not conservative values, right. No. But they did, and now they're getting a lot of flack from the homosexual community. And so the Family Research Council, our partner organization out in Washington, D.C., FRC.org, highlighted them as a group that's now being targeted. So we at The Boundless Show want to give them a shout and support for what they are doing. And you, too, can voice your support, too. Go to FRC.org for more information.
Well, apparently they're being strong-armed by the AFL-CIO, and so FRC is organizing a petition and asking people to please sign it and send letters saying, hey, what does this have to do with collective bargaining?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's a little off message for the unions.
I'm distracted by all the acronyms.
I was just going to say, this is an acronym-filled show.
TMI. It's just
the union people don't like the fact
This is what I can understand.
That a small, successful juice company is saying that marriage is a lifelong commitment between a man and a woman.
You know, well, I think FLCIO is so wise with all their dollars. I mean, they never throw their money at anything controversial or questionable.
Oh,
you
no.
Know.
No.
Wasn't it an individual, one of the individual owners that supported?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't the company itself. It was just the
just a shareholder.
Shareholder.
Investor. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bolthouse, they just want them to stick to carrots, okay? And anytime that
they
stray,
do a good job with carrots.
They do a great job with carrots.
They know their way around a carrot.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. So we just want to make sure that we are out there. I always like to keep an ear out for organizations that are doing good things and taking a stand because it's risky.
Right. You know? It's interesting when a big labor organization would say a juice company shouldn't really be getting into this, because after all, why should the big labor company be getting into this?
Well, a juice company headquartered in the state where all this stuff is happening. It's not like they're trying to affect something in Thailand. I'm like, good grief.
Thank you.
sitting around the table for our round table. We have the team here to talk about success. Now, this is not a self-help seminar, though it probably could turn into one. We'll see how it see
we
what transpires.
We have all the answers to success.
No
right
prosperity
here
preachers
table
here.
If you but have your own podcast, you are successful.
Exactly. But we have, I don't know, I don't think we can delineate really between the men and the women, because maybe men...
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, maybe we will during the course of the conversation, but, you know, men maybe traditionally have more pressure to define success and to achieve success and what that looks like. But then when you Christianize it, then you get the big smackdown about, you know, it's not just about success. So then you have to fight those kind of perceptions about, you know, it's not just about you.
What are you talking about?
So, talking about success.
Well, no, the Christianize it part.
Because, like, it's not right to, you know, to achieve, because have to give everything to the Lord.
You have to put it in a religious veneer.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where you're still wanting to be successful, but you're trying to spiritualize it.
Because your Learjet is what's going to make it possible for you to go reap the white harvest. And
in your big house, you can have a lot of Bible studies in.
Right. So it's got to be framed appropriately.
Exactly. And you're lodged in the mountains where you bring young life groups.
You're in home theater so you can...
Oh, now we're talking about Ted's life. Because
that's been put off for a year.
That's his ministry goal right
Praise
now.
Praise the Lord. I am glad to hear it.
At least a year.
That's been bugging me.
At least.
How many inches was that TV going to be?
It's only 73.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
that's huge. Goodness.
But it's only so he can show the passion to his neighbors.
Ted, it will you not understand.
It will not fulfill. Take it from
me.
Are
we talking about movies or are we talking about success?
I'm talking about the large screen TV.
So where were you, Lisa?
So what does this mean then in a culture where we know now from studies that millennials, for example, we've been told that they care about, you know, they're on the social justice bandwagons. They want to help. They want to care for people. They're about the orphans. But really, the facts show that, in fact, they're pursuing success at just as great a rate as those who are older and in the older generations. And I think, you know, if you look at the way it plays out in our churches, many of the people in our churches are living in just as swank of homes, driving the nice cars, doing the fun things, going on the high-end vacations as their non-Christian counterparts. So how are we defining success? What is that looking like in the church?
Well, and I know that particular millennial study was talking about how they are likely to say they want to be rich and famous, that in fact to a higher degree than previous generations. And so even as they might have stronger ideals about social justice or other issues, that there still is this compass inside them that says, I will know I've been successful when I'm famous, when I'm recognized for what I'm doing, when I'm getting accolades for it, or when there's some kind of cash out, when I can make money, when I have my book deal, when I get a great job.
When I become the American Idol.
Yeah, that there's still this sense that it's not a great thing unless it's capped by a lot of money or a lot of recognition.
Mm-hmm. Well, almost like they can do it from a spot of comfort. You know, it's like when people say, I want to live my life the way I want to live it, but then I certainly want to throw a little bit of Jesus in when I have time for him. And, you know, you look at people like Angelina Jolie, Oprah, who are doing good things, but that's when they're not doing their 4-week spa stays and they're not doing their, you know, and it's just kind of like, what's the distinction?
Well, you know, a good example was, 11 years ago when Princess Di and Mother Teresa died within a month of each other, that you had a lot of people who felt bad that they weren't celebrating Mother Teresa's death as much, but they were more attracted to the rich and famous lifestyle of Princess Di, who had a charitable side to her, who was gracious or whatever. And they knew that Mother Teresa had gained some sense of famousness, I guess, because a lot of people had heard of her, but it wasn't like that's what her end goal was. And her life had a slice of famousness to it, but it had mostly the opposite of rich and famous.
I think this really does come back to heart attitude, because I know just from my own life, I feel a twinge of guilt over how much money I have compared to the rest of the world. And there is that sense of, I better do some good works. I better do some charity. I better show some true religion, as Scripture defines it, you know, caring for the orphans and widows. And I wonder if the Oprahs and Angelina Jolies don't have that to an even greater degree, thinking, okay, I did my, you know, I started the school in Africa and I've adopted the kids from other countries who were really in need, and that assuages a lot of that guilt when they are laying there, you know, with the mud wraps for 4 weeks or whatever they do at a spa. And so the hard attitude of, am I pursuing job and money and success at work for its as an end in itself, or am I pursuing being faithful? And some of those material benefits accrue to me because I did a good job. I think there's a real difference in how the person lives that out based on how they think about it.
Yeah, I don't trust myself with all the goodness that God has given me. I know that I will spend the money that I have on myself. I think it's good to look for opportunities. I'm glad that those rich and famous are doing that, and I think it's a good exercise for us all to look for ways to give of ourselves that way, whether it's our money, whether it's our time. Getting back to your statement that you made, Lisa, about you know the Christians look just like the non-Christians. You have prosperity preachers out there telling Christians to do that, that is their end goal. My wife and I were watching one last night, and he was talking about expectations, that if you expect it, he was equating that with faith. If you expect it, you will get that. If you start out the day by expecting good things to happen to you, expecting that promotion, expecting that house, like that's what life is about.
Well, and what's the difference between expecting and feeling entitled? That all of a sudden you lose your faith in God because he's not delivered on what you feel entitled to.
I wonder if there are two different concepts about success. There's the daily successes of doing well on a school paper, of preparing a good meal, of giving a great presentation at work, of getting notoriety as an author or whatever. There are these daily successes. But then there's an ultimate success when you're at the end of your life or before the throne of God, or even just in a moment of introspection, thinking about, you know, is my life, not just my daily activities, but is my life a success? And perhaps we are looking at a successful life as the accumulation of a number of successful events.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it's totally, maybe a successful life is something totally different.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like in the end of It's a Wonderful Life when you've got the whole community there and they're all pouring their money into the big basket and they're telling George Bailey that he's the richest man in town. That few people get that experience in life, that really what accumulates is often a very abstract thing, and you don't get one big shining moment where it all coalesces and you really recognize just how successful you are.
Yeah, and I think I've been there. I don't know if it's like that for both men and women, but I felt that pressure of success, that pressure of achievement. And when I get like that even now, and when I do, I like to think small. Where am I right now? What role has God given me? And so I think about my role as a husband. And am I being faithful in my role as a husband? Am I being faithful in my role as father or worker here at Focus on the Family? I really like to narrow it down and not think about those big successes or those big wins. Not that they're wrong, but you can go too far and you can set yourself up for, I don't know, frustration.
Well, and two, especially when you consider life as a journey and that it's so easy to be so focused on the next vista that you don't stop and enjoy where you are now. So some of the small things Ted was talking about, that we lose the value of those if we're discontent and thinking, I've got to keep focused on the fact that this isn't my final destination. I got to keep looking ahead. Candace and I talk about that a lot, that especially here in Colorado, there's so many places where you can just get some incredible views of the mountains and the scenery and that. But at the same time, there's this sense of, well, we have to keep driving and okay, hurry up and, you know, enjoy that view, but we got to move on. And so often in life, God's wanting us to slow down and say, this is a scene that I've given you. The day is a day that I've made. Rejoice and be glad in it.
Mm-hmm.
And without that sense of contentment and thankfulness, that's where the enemy can come in and create this sense of we got to have more.
And not that you can't have dreams, but I'm not sure about the end goal. If the end goal is what you're striving for, I'm not sure that that's what God wants us to do.
Well, but Christ told us what should drive us. He said, seek first the kingdom and all these things will be added.
Yeah.
And so if you are driven by a desire ultimately for money or fame or fortune, you're not following what Christ told you to do. And there's so much rest when you know you are seeking first the kingdom and trusting him to then let whatever he wants you to have accrue to your life.
Yeah, and success may not be what God has for you. One of my favorite Oswald Chambers quotes is, we must never put our dreams of success as God's purpose for us. His purpose may be exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
God's purpose is to glorify himself in us and through us. And it doesn't mean we're going to have a big house. It doesn't mean we're going to be VP or president.
And you may get the big house. But if you do, remember, Jesus also talked about how the rich young ruler would have a hard time getting into the kingdom because the trappings of wealth are just that. They're trappings. They tend to ensnare, and it takes an extra level of vigilance to not lose your perspective and your compass, your true north setting, if you really are materially successful.
Well, and Dr. Dobson talks about how so many of the things we want to have end up having us, and that some of the things that we see as success become chains because they trap us to the maintenance of that success. And Candace and I were reading this book, Richistan, that talks about these newly wealthy people and how so much of their life is spent trying to manage the money and to do the conspicuous consumption that's expected of someone of their means, to where they can't even enjoy the life that they were apparently going after.
Well, these trappings are a subtle temptress too. I mean, you become affected, you become used to it, and I tell you, one of the hardest things in life is reversal.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
If you've accumulated these things, if you've accumulated the big salary or and all the stuff, doesn't mean you're going to have them forever. And reversal is
Well, and that's exactly what's happening right now in the housing crisis, is that people who overbuilt or overbought, who are having to go backwards now, are having to deal with exactly that. Whereas our grandparents' generation slowly accumulated, and then by the end of their life had this big collection of stuff to show for.
But even the grandparents' homes that we visited are really small compared to what we have.
And but that, you know, even that's not the ultimate goal, to live comfortably in your twilight years.
Well, and even houses are such an obvious example of the kind of wealth we value, which is physical stuff. But our houses are twice as big as our grandparents' generation, but our families are half the size.
Mm-hmm.
And the grandparents would look and say, you know, the wealth was the relationships. It was the family, even if they felt a little tight in their house.
Yeah.
I think one thing that's kind of discouraging is just how, in light of that, you see how like attracts like. So if you're a yuppie climber, you're going to attract yuppie climbers, and that completely separates you from a whole class of people. And you see this in the church too, people that are going to the yuppie, you know, the yuppie churches and stuff, and it doesn't put you in contact with. That's why we have to have huge programs in our churches to go, you know, oh my goodness, let's form a committee and go out and find some poor people, because we're just not interacting with people. It's just so sad. And
well, in fact, there are demographic studies now that say we are the most isolated in terms of one zip code to the next being so homogenous. That used to, we would have these really mixed neighborhoods where you meet all types. And now it is very likely that your neighbors are going to be about as identical to you as we've ever had in the history of the country.
Mm-hmm. And I think just getting back to what you guys were saying earlier about motives and stuff, I think it is a misplaced affection and almost misplaced motives, in the sense that it reminds me of just when I was in high school and I was determined that I was going to go to Yale. And to go to Yale, all my friends were trying to do the same thing. And we basically just started our lists of, I'm going to need to be a candy striper, I'm going to need to go volunteer here, blah, blah, blah. We had no interest in sick people. We had no interest in helping anyone other than ourselves. But we just were filling in the lists of things that we had to do. And you look at the, you know, even biblical examples, it's just... Where in the Bible does God ever really use someone or, you know, honor someone who was out for self-promotion? Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Saul. You know, he thought he was going to be the king. No. Ananias and Sapphira, dead. But all the people who didn't want the glory, you know, Moses, Solomon, all these people, God chose to bless them because they were just trying to be faithful in what they were doing. And I think my... I think of my dad, who started out as a, you know, he got a business degree and then went to seminary and became a pastor. And my folks started out in the Philippines and they loved being missionaries. But through a series of circumstances, they basically got kicked off the mission field. Then my dad became a pastor. He got kicked out of two churches just because of griping people. One of them, for example, didn't like the way that he did the bulletin and basically pulled together a committee and got him ousted out of the church for that. Total craziness. My dad's last job was as a custodian. And it was like, you know, talk about a career trajectory. Like any man would say, that's like the worst, you know, track record ever. But again, and I've said this before, at his funeral, more people came up and said, your dad led me to the Lord. Your dad helped us keep our marriage together. Your dad encouraged me in a really tough time. I did not commit suicide because of your dad. And it was just, you know, how do we measure success? And in the end, what is it going to look like?
Choice to make. I'm tired of my yesterdays looking just like today, always the same. Been reading familiar lines. I'm hoping to renew my mind with the color of the phrases, red and black on wrinkled pages.
For this week's culture segment, I have with me in the studio Glenn Packiam. Glenn is a worship pastor actually at New Life Church right here in Colorado Springs, Colorado, part of the Desperation Band, which many of our listeners probably are familiar with Desperation Band. I would go into a few bars of I Am Free, which is kind of a fun anthem of mine that I sing. But anyway, welcome, Glenn.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, we're going to be talking to Glenn, actually. He has a book called Butterfly in Brazil, How Your Life Can Make a World of Difference. Mm-hmm. And obviously something that resonates with our audience, Glenn. And, you know, this reminds me, actually, last night I was reading LarkNews.com, which is a great source of news for me. Mm-hmm. No, it's kind of the Christian version of The Onion, for those of you who don't know. But they had a story in there on testimony crimes and how there's a rise in testimony crimes of people that are out committing crimes so that they can get a better testimony. And, you know, because they want the ones that can kind of go on tour instead of so I grew up in a believing household. No one wants that. And that's kind of my testimony. They want to be saved out of something and just have something awesome, you know, that they can tell people. Obviously, your book is refuting that kind of nonsense. And you're saying basically that great things that have been done not only for the kingdom, but just within culture are often done in small increments. And why don't you start off by telling us, Glenn, a little bit about really what spurred the idea for this book in the first place?
Sure. Well, I'm one of those non-dramatic testimony people. I grew up in a Christian home in Malaysia. And I remember from, you know, when I was a wee little lad, we didn't speak like that, but, you know.
Your Irish,
my
Malaysian,
Irish other apparently. Malaysian roots, yeah.
Okay.
But I remember going to these children's camps and hearing stories about missionaries and hearing stories about people who did these dramatic things from God. And at an early age, I was so moved by those stories. I was so taken with those stories. I spent most of my middle school years devouring every biography I could get my hands on about great men and women of God. And always felt like, yeah, sign me up for that. I want to be numbered among, you know, that group of people. I want to be part of that. And then when I went to college, I went to a Christian university where it seemed like it was kind of like, you know, the X-Men school for the talented and gifted or whatever. It was sort of like the Christian version of that. Everybody who goes here has some sort of special power or special calling, and they're the future Billy Graham or the future so-and-so. And it almost seemed, you know, almost a little bit silly, but everybody had these bombastic dreams, and no one would quite say it this way, but it seemed like the bigger your dream was, the more God it had to be, you know, which I understand there's some truth to that. But the problem is that, you know, I'm you know, confession. I'm like almost 10 years removed from my college graduation. And I know a lot of the people that I used to hang out with and talk with, and life gets more ordinary as you get older. Mm-hmm. And at some point you sort of, you're faced with this question and you say, all right, so am I just not one of the special types? Am I not one of those that they're going to write a book about? Am I not the one that's going to be famous or make this kind of dent or mark in history? And I think this is the point where so many people in their 20s get disillusioned. They either start to say, well, maybe all of it was a hoax. Maybe everything about my faith even was not real. And there's a cynicism that happens. Or there's just kind of a discouragement that says, okay, well, I guess there's the, you know, the real heroes, and then there's me. You know, mm-hmm. there's the heroes of the faith, and then there's me. I got nothing. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the inspiration for writing this, because I work with a lot of young people at our college ministry here at New Life called The Mill, and part of my day job at the church is to help train worship leaders for local churches through the New Life School of Worship. And so many young people come in with these grand dreams, and it's wonderful. But then a few years down the road, it's sort of the zeal fizzles out because they're discouraged. And they say, well, I don't know what to do from here, where to go from here. And I found so much encouragement personally from the story of Nehemiah in the scriptures, because Nehemiah, to me, is a bit of an aberration from your normal Bible action heroes. You know, you got David who killed Goliath, you have Moses who parts the Red Sea, does all these miracles, you know, Elijah calls down fire from heaven. Nehemiah is a guy that builds a wall, and that's the high point, you know. But yet he gets a whole book named after him. How did this guy sneak into the scriptures? Mm-hmm. So anyway, through the course of this book, Butterfly in Brazil, I unpack some clues, some secrets from Nehemiah's life that I've found to be helpful for myself, and I think can be helpful for others in realizing, look, the way you make lasting change isn't always the way you think. It's a bit counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I like how you do draw that story from Nehemiah. I think also you mentioned Moses, and I like several years ago I heard Rick Warren speak, and he talked about Moses meeting God at the burning bush. Mm-hmm. And the one thing God asked him was, it wasn't, you know, let's look ahead 30 years, or, you know, here's something awesome I have for you. He just said, what's in your hand? Mm-hmm. And basically Moses was just holding a staff. Mm-hmm. And Rick used that to talk about how, what has God placed in your hand, your influence, right, your gifts, your, you know, the tangible things that you currently have, and what can you in turn do for them. So knowing that, for example, some of our folks out there, no one's writing a book right now about the Christian accountant who's sitting in an office pulling out some spreadsheets each day and, you know, floor 17 of some high rise. So what encouragement can you give to that person as to how is God going to use the accountant?
You know, I think there's a lot about it that's a mystery to us, and maybe that's part of the challenge, is we don't see on this earth the impact that our small decisions are making. But I think change, and you can see this in Scripture, and you can actually see this in different instances in history, but change happens by small actions, people acting within their sphere, just like you said. The way I word it is, change is small, change is local, and change is gradual. Now, change is local doesn't mean geographic anymore. With technology, anything within our reach is sort of local. But I think there is this thing of believing that if you believe that this is what God has you doing in this season, then you do it like you believe it's a great work. Mm-hmm. There's this moment in the Nehemiah story where the wall's almost done, and his enemies come and they try to distract him, try to get him to come down. And he sends a message back to them. He says, you tell them I can't come down. I'm engaged in a great work. And four more times they ask him the same thing. And four times he gives the same reply. And I imagine myself, if I was sitting there next to Nehemiah, I would have said, hey, psst, I wouldn't say you're doing a great work. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you're inflating this a little bit. You're swinging a hammer. You're laying bricks. There's nothing so great about this. But yet it was because he believed that it was great. And that's what gave him the strength to sort of stay the course. And I think for all of us, we have to believe, look, greatness isn't found in the task we're doing. Greatness is found in the obedience to God. You know, and this, if what we're doing is being lived out in obedience to God, then it is, we ought to believe that it is a great work. You know?
Okay. So how have you seen this in your own life? Like, really, what, you know, what challenges did you come up against, or who did you compare yourself to, or whatever? Because I would say, Okay, look, I'm quite frankly, I'm going I sit in a cubicle all day, Glenn, okay? Now, you, in comparison to me, I'd be like, Glenn, what is he talking about? He's like a, you know, music superstar, whatever. So talk about your ordinary experiences and what you're up against.
You know, it's always relative, and the trap of the success game is there's always someone who's more successful than you. There's always someone who's doing something more dramatic than you. And so it is a sliding scale, and it's this never-ending chase. I think for me, when I graduated from college, I stayed on a year and was asked to be the worship leader there and led worship for their chapel services. And to me, at that point in my life, I thought, this is the peak of my game. You know, I'm 21, 22, I'm leading worship with thousands of students. There's TV cameras, whatever. I thought it was amazing. And after that year, unmistakably, it really felt like the Lord was calling me to come out here to New Life. And when I started at New Life, it wasn't a staff position. I was asked to be an apprentice to Ross Parsley, who's the worship pastor mm-hmm. there. And my great role was to make copies of music for the choir rehearsal and push around a cart around
awesome.
The campus and set up the sectional rooms. And there were plenty of moments that year where I thought, man, what have I become? Have I lost all of my connections and my mm-hmm. networking stuff and all the people I knew and my Rolodex of contacts from college and it seemed like, man, this is a dead end, you know? But it was also during that year that I began to fall in love with the local church and began to realize, look, it's not about you know, a traveling roadshow, and there's value in that and all that. But for me, I began to sort of fall in love with the idea of being consistent with people, staying with people, watching them grow over the long term. And I started helping out with our college ministry, which at that point had just started meeting weekly. It was 30, 40 people on a Friday night, and I started leading worship for that and have had the privilege of watching that grow and seeing people that I knew, you know, 7, 8 years ago that are still involved with it today. So, and even now with the Desperation Band, that's part of one of the core commitments for all of us at New Life is we're not going to travel more than we're home. In fact, by the vast majority, we're home more than we're gone. And we have a rule where we don't miss more than one Sunday or one Friday night or one Wednesday night service a month. And if we do, we need, you know, a big pastoral exception for that, you mm-hmm. know. Just because we want to believe that, look, this thing that we're doing, that we're in this local church is more important, is the great work, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like what you say about that, the concept of change. You say change is small, change is local, change is gradual, change is costly. Mm-hmm. And I think that we do get caught in the trap of saying, you know, I need to do something big. I need to just head out on some trajectory where I'm going to, you know, I'll make millions and then coast and mm-hmm. give some of it to the Lord, you know, whatever. but it is true. And I think that many people, it doesn't have to be necessarily within your line of work. There's a lot of opportunity for ministry apart from that. Now, obviously, where you are placed is a great avenue of ministry as well. Sitting at that desk, sitting in the cubicle, interacting with coworkers, and being faithful in what God's called you to do there is huge.
Yeah. And the other step you mentioned, you kind of alluded to this, is other things that we can do. And one of the things we did with Butterfly in Brazil is a portion of the proceeds are going to support World Relief. Mm. And I know there's a bajillion relief organizations and they're all doing wonderful things. At some point you pick one, you know, and included in the back of the book is a catalog of different things from $10 stuff to $100 stuff that a person can do that makes a difference. And I think, you know, I don't want to just limit this and say, hey, you know, just keep doing what you're doing and it's all fine. I think there's also this element of, look, if you have a burden for what's happening in Africa, you have a burden for what's happening here and there, well, then don't just wait for the day that you, like you said, make it rich and then donate millions, you know, like Bill mm-hmm. Gates, you retired 52 and, mm-hmm. you know, spend the rest of your life working out your foundation to eliminate poverty. I think there's small things we can do now, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's a message for all of us, but particularly 20-somethings, because we tend to have this life on TiVo sort of, you know, mm-hmm. view where I can just kind of put my passions or my purpose on pause while I just kind of hang out and do this. But all of that stuff is for another time. Well, why not now? Why not act on it in small ways now?
Right. Well, and I think just what you say reminds me so much of how rarely, if ever, does God entrust huge things to someone who hasn't been tested in the small things.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's not where we're going to go out and start, you know, starting crusades or whatever when in fact you know, you're cheating on your timesheet or your,
right.
you know, it's just you need to be faithful in the small things when no one is watching, when God, you know, and then God will, I think as Bill Hybels says, give you a holy discontent.
Right.
He'll give you a vision for something that you can start affecting small change in. So,
yeah, and that's seen in Nehemiah's life as well, because he began as a cupbearer to an evil king, the Persian
mm-hmm.
king.
Mm-hmm.
And yet early in the book of Nehemiah, it says that he had never before appeared sad in the king's presence, which
mm-hmm.
I think is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Here he is serving a wicked king. With a high-risk job. You know, he's tasting the wine before the king does to make sure it's not poisoned and all that kind of thing. So high-risk job, wicked boss.
Mm-hmm.
This guy has every reason to appear sad or grumpy or down in the king's presence, but yet he never had. And so then the one day that he comes in and he can't hide his burden or can't hide his grief, the king notices.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, it's Nehemiah's faithfulness with a small, meaningless task to a wicked boss that opens the door for him to do the thing that ends up being his life work,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, the book is Butterfly in Brazil by Glenn Packiam, How Your Life Can Make a World of Difference. Do go to boundless.org and we will have that featured there. So make sure you check out a copy. Also check out the music of Glenn and team. Make sure you do that. I'm sure at some point in the near future, they're going to have me as at least a backup singer on an upcoming
album. Yeah, we'll work on the contract
album,
right now.
So
yeah.
We'll look forward to that happening. But it was great to have you here, Glenn. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
You look at me, I do not deserve the love you've given me. I could not have earned for such a lowly man. You would come to earth and give up everything, and you would pick up the broken pieces, awake this heart of mine. You put your life inside me, showed me what it is to die. Now this life I'm living, it is no longer mine. It's the beauty of my Savior, the story of His grace alive.
We're back this week for a Mentor Series segment, again with Danielle Crittenden, as this time she talks to the ladies, discussing the topic of marriage and how you can get there just a little bit sooner.
What practical things would you tell young women they can do to avoid the delay toward marriage?
I think the one thing, if I have one message that I would try to pass to my own daughter, as well as other young women, which is start thinking about marriage seriously at a younger age than you would think or be told to think about. That I think when girls become 18 or 19, the message around that they hear constantly, whether it's from the media or the magazines they read or their own mothers or friends, is that you've now just entered a long period of dating. It's the message actually we used to give young men. Now is the time to sow your wild oats. Don't tie yourself down. Go out into the world. Spend the next decade even experimenting and figuring it out what it is you want before you tie yourself down. And I think that can be a very destructive message, because it's not that you want to say to girls, hey, get married at 19, but that they should approach dating in a way that is serious, that they are trying to meet the person they want to settle down with. And he may walk in when you're 21 and you don't want to be close to that. On the other hand, you don't want to just be endlessly setting yourself up to play the field. You want your dating to be directed to marriage, not just into a void of something and marriage being something you'll get around to. And I think that we know, and one of the hard lessons of my generation was, we pretended we didn't have a biological window. We pretended that we were on the same schedules and of men, and our biology was virtually the same as men. We just had different plumbing. And the harsh reality was that by postponing childbirth into our 30s, many of us were simply unable to have the children and the families, the lives that we had always sort of secretly wanted or openly planned for. That's where the dating, if you approach your 20s, is just an endless green meadow to run through heedlessly without thinking of the future. that's how you end up being a 30-year-old woman wondering what's happened to your life. So I think if you just start earlier thinking hard about marriage and what you want out of it and what sort of man you want to meet, I think you will tend to get married earlier at an age that is going to enable you to have the kind of family and life that you want.
I want to ask another follow-up on the man question. A lot of my single friends just say there are no good men left, at least not in this city or, you know, this church or wherever they happen to spend most of their time. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about the potential impact of pornography and video games on why there seems to be a vacuum of good men.
I don't think there's a shortage of good men. I think, as we were saying earlier in the sexual revolution deal, that there's just not the same pressure among men to get married. That look, and men have a great deal without marriage. It took a lot, used to take a lot of societal pressure to get them into marriage and then further to make them stay married. That you know, lives are much longer than they used to be. You're with somebody, you know, 40, 50 years. You're asking a man to make, you know, a lot of sacrifices on his freedom, on his wallet, if you stay home, on his potential sexual activity that he can have to stay with one woman through all those years. So you can see why many men are reluctant, you know, to settle down, and especially settle down if there's no pressure on them to do so. And women traditionally have put that pressure on men and have set the rules amongst each other about how we're going to behave, how we're going to treat men who treat us badly. And we saw through the 70s a lot of those standards just break down, that as divorce has become easy and very non-judgmental, women will have sex indiscriminately, that makes it a lot harder to pressure into marriage. So I don't think there are fewer good men out there. I just think that the pressure upon them to be good in a monogamous, long-lasting relationship is just dramatically lessened.
Now, the pressure used to come from their parents, even maybe from employers of some men, but would the pressure from women have been the trump card of all of those?
It came at them from all sides, and it came at them in the name of women. I mean, it was in women's interests to have her husband stay with her, you know, through all these years. I mean, just in a crude sociological way, through all the years of child rearing. I think it's true. I think it's even true today and remains true that a man who is 40 or 45 and unmarried is a very suspicious character to other women. A heterosexual man who is unmarried at 45, I think, just broadcasts trouble. And in fact, in his employer's view, I think there's still a little skepticism that why is Ted not, you know, you don't trust him as much as an employee. Why won't he make the commitment to a family like we all have? Does that say something about his commitment to company or work or whatever? So I think there is still a little bit of that stigma on men. And it's also true that the upside of the marriage deal for them is we now know from statistics that they live longer, they're healthier, they go farther.
You're saying, go get that looked at. You need to have that checked out.
As a woman, I know that men can't even boil an egg half the time on their own. The point is they get married when they get sick of pizza, takeout pizza, and living on their college sofa.
We don't explore the other food groups.
With popcorn scattered all over the floor. Like, no, men like homes, you know, and eventually they want, I think, a home, and they want children. It's just that they don't have to do it as quickly as they used to. And there's less, once they've done it, there's much less pressure on them to stay in it and commit themselves to it.
before. So throw the doors wide open. I've got a brand new love. A love that lifts me up. Stuck on the tip of my tongue. 'Cause words are not enough. I've got a brand new love. Like blue skies opening up. A new day has begun. 'Cause I've got a brand new love.
Opening up this week's Boundless Inbox, I have Candace with me in the studio to address a question from a young lady.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Candace. And this one is what I call the proverbial quagmire, so you're going to have to be ready for it.
Okay.
This is going to be helpful to a lot of us. She says, I am really struggling with my friendship with my best friend. We've gone through some rough spots together, but have come out stronger through it all. This time has really been painful for me because we like the same young man. I'm not sure she knows I like him, but sometimes I sense that she's suspicious. He's an awesome guy. He treats us both pretty much the same, as far as I can tell. But I'm fearful that sometime in the not-so-distant future, I'll be left with a broken heart. For a while, she's been lucky enough to see him pretty often, as their families are becoming good friends. How can I know who he likes so I can back off if needed and move on? Plus, do you have any advice on how to deal with the jealousy I've been feeling? How do I respond to my friend if she's the one rejected? I'm trying not to go on too much, but I wish I could say how much I respect him and want his respect. I really want to do the right thing for him and to be loyal to my best friend.
Well, this is the ultimate dilemma for women who tend to have close friendships with other women. And
this
inevitably,
is like what movie scripts are written about.
Exactly. Inevitably, because it seems there are so few really awesome guys that come into the midst of these friendship circles, when one does, it's like everybody says, I've got dibs on him. And in my experience, it was always the girl who had the best flirting skills who always seemed to win out every time, which left everybody else every time feeling frustrated and left out. And, you know, one of the real problems is that these kinds of situations do have the power to break up a friendship. That last line, though, Lisa, read me the last line again, because that sort of caught my attention.
The one about respect?
About who she's worried about.
Oh, well, she says she wants to do the right thing for him and to be loyal to her best friend.
And I think that's admirable, but I'm curious why she's not wanting to do the right thing for her as well. If she's attracted to this young man, if he has the potential to be a godly husband, and why wouldn't she be praying for her own victory in the situation? I do think that female-to-female loyalty can be a bit of a problem when a romance happens with one of the friends. And whether she gets the guy or her friend gets the guy, once those two start pairing off, it's definitely bound to create jealousy, tension. It certainly will and should change the nature of the friendship, because ultimately what you should be moving toward is a best friend relationship with a spouse. And so just a couple of thoughts is to, one, not put so much emotional energy into a female friendship that a future engagement and marriage has the ability to devastate you, because you're moving into that season of life where people get married and they start to pair off, and that's appropriate. And so it's not high school anymore. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is to not let yourself be drawn into a flirting competition. Mm-hmm. That if you find yourself feeling really competitive with your friend, I think the best thing to do is just back off and pray for the grace to be at peace with who God made you to be, how your personality may be different than hers, and two, to just trust that if this is meant to be for you, that the young man will follow you as you back away. You know, that as you pull back a little bit from the friendship with her, that maybe he will want to spend more time with you, and that would be a good indicator of who he's interested in. If, on the other hand, he is interested in her, it's going to be time for you to probably find some new friends to spend more of your time with, because she's going to be preoccupied with him. Mm-hmm. This also raises the issue of why mentors and or chaperones are so helpful, because they can kind of guide these relationships and make sure that it's not turning into, you know, like picking teams for recess softball. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody's
Red
just,
Rover.
Exactly.
Oh, flashbacks.
Everybody's standing there sweating, thinking, do I have the skill to be picked at least in the third string, or am I mm-hmm. going to be the last one standing? That is just no fun for anybody. So I would say if you feel like it's a competition and it's you against her for his affection, that's just not a healthy situation. It's not going to be good for your friendship long term, and it's not going to be good for any romantic relationship that would come out of this, be it with you or with her. So to just back away, pull back a little bit, and pray for some opportunities to redirect your efforts and your energies into some other more productive channels.
Hmm. Well, I think this is really an interesting question, and I think maybe that will merit a roundtable discussion on just friendships in general, because mm-hmm. I think women especially can get extremely ugly when it comes to situations like this, when you feel like you're being pitted one against the other. And now, as I reread, when you asked me to reread that last portion, you know, I think she is concerned about this guy and about her friend because, well, really what she's saying, I think, Candace, and maybe you can tell me what you think, is she's concerned about her reaction to both of them or her attitude towards both of them. Because I think as women, we can often intentionally or unintentionally begin to undermine the other person when there is jealousy there. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you'll find yourself slipping in little things about the person that are maybe negative about them, or not highlighting good things about the person that would be very... And it's just, it's so horrible. It can just be horrible.
I think the human nature is, in this situation, to become catty and competitive. And so my challenge is, rather than doing what you feel like you want to do, do the opposite and pull back and create some distance, and then observe how he reacts to that. Because if he is interested in you, he will follow you as you pull back, and that distance will help you long term if he is interested in you, because the friend won't then be so much a part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, good thoughts. So okay, that's it for this week's question. You heard Candace's response. Give us your feedback, editor@boundless.org, and any future questions that you would like to see us address for this segment. Until then, I'm Lisa Anderson, your host for this week's edition of The Boundless Show. We'll see you around next time.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on family.